Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August the 24th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Judy Weisdeck. Today's session number is 2001-5 and is titled The Bystanders. Let's listen in on Judy's presentation.
With an address and the amount the book would cost, you can get it in hardback or coverback. I think it's excellent. I think it's an excellent book. So I brought some copies along. If some of you are going to be around here another day or two, there's extra copies up there. You can read them. I would like them back. I'm kind of hoarding in order to be able to use them in the future. I'm not sure that you're always going to get a newspaper to do something like that and give you the opportunity to share that with everyone. The topic we're going to talk about today is entitled Bystanders, but it goes a little bit beyond bystanders. In order to understand the bystanders, we have to understand the environment. Now, as we defined bystanders earlier in the week, we said bystanders were people that were from the communities, from the countries, be they Germany, France, England, wherever, that didn't do anything to assist those who were being persecuted. I'm going to focus primarily on Germany because I think that is the one area that most of us think about when we think of the Holocaust, but it was true in many cases. And as we do that, we're also going to look at those of you who had seen the wave. One of the questions that came out was, why did that particular community not react the same way? Why did they take an active role and go out and help the Jewish people at the time? And I think that should come out in what we're discussing today. There aren't going to be any slides. I'm not showing a movie. So some of it is going to be... What?
Here's a question.
Oh,
I have
yes.
A question to you, Dan.
So, okay. Sorry. Some of... That's all right. Some of it may seem a little heavy at first, but I think we need to look at the whole picture to understand why people did what they did. We don't do things in isolation. There are elements in our lives that cause us to do things. Now, before I go on, what is your question?
The term bystander, and previously we had a term righteous, that when you were reading that book, the passage Wednesday, and it was talking about a woman who was keeping them at her farm, but she was doing it for money. And as soon as it started to get dangerous, she kicked them out. Is that, I wouldn't consider that a righteous approach.
And she would not have been included. You're right. You're right on. She would not have been included in the category of the righteous to qualify for the avenue of the righteous that they recognize in Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. She did help them, and the help was greatly appreciated, but she did it for money. And as soon as her own life or her own family was threatened, that was it. And that doesn't fall into the same category.
So would she be considered a bystander then? Or is it?
We've got to have a gray area, I guess, between the two. Because she did do something for a while.
Yeah.
So I think you'd kind of, you know, she's not really a bystander and did nothing. She did a little and then quit as soon as it got dangerous to her.
Judy?
Yes.
Will you be telling us something about the wave for those of us who haven't been here before? Is this a popular movie?
It's a movie I brought along, and it's a movie based upon a community in France up in the mountains that did take Polish people in, Jewish people in, many of them Polish, but also from France, when they were being deported to the various concentration camps. I'll tell you, I would be very glad to let people use it and view it themselves if they want. There are video opportunities around here because I had previewed another one, and I'll have it here. I'm going to use it again next week, but if somebody wants to borrow it and view it, they certainly can. In it, you find an entire community just kind of did it, and they did it by not ever using the word Jew when somebody arrived. When they handled them, when they placed them in homes, they would come into the churches. One of the things that helped them not well, helped them to do it in an organized fashion without an organization as such to start with was the priests. And they took a very active role of, when they come in on Sunday, they'd say, I have three Old Testaments that have arrived. Does anyone want them? And people would volunteer to take them, and that meant there were three Jews that needed to be placed. And the video is very powerful. The one thing... No, that's not the wave.
No.
I'm sorry. That's the active people. Get my brain together. It's right. The wave is a classroom instruction that went on, and it's a true story of a teacher in California who was a social studies teacher, and he was dealing with that period of history, and the students ask, well, why didn't anyone do anything? Why did everybody just do what they were told? Why didn't anyone help? Well, in the video, you watch him do an experiment in his class. He almost lost his job over this. Did this experiment where he slowly gets the entire student population of his classes. And other kids used to skip classes and come to his class to be a part of it. He makes them see a solidarity, and I think you'll see a real close tie-in with what I am going to be talking about up here as far as Luther is concerned and his stand, because he believed, and one of his strong stands was, that you needed to support your country. You support nationality, and in the wave they were supporting their beliefs. And he talked about it. He got he had three tenets or beliefs, and one was discipline. Those of you that saw it, what were
they? community
and action. And he took them one at a time and slowly got the kids to do this. By the 3/4 of the way through the film, they are such a tight-knit group. They will do anything, including report on others who do not follow the rules, including attacking people verbally and physically that do not follow the rules. It's just interesting how you can just be pulled along. And he did this in the classroom. He got into a lot of trouble because toward the end, before he actually brought them to the forefront and had the entire group of people belonging to the wave see their leader. He said, he will be here today. He is running across the entire United States. We're starting organizations in all the schools. You will see your leader. And the kids were so excited. They made banners. They made armbands. They had costumes anyway. They had a symbol that they followed. I mean, so much of it is so parallel to what the Nazis did. And then they sat there and waited and waited. He had them build up the suspense. Then when he turned on the video cameras for them to see, it was Hitler. So it's a very powerful movie. Anyway, back to this, as far as environment is concerned. I noticed a look of surprise on some of your faces as far as Luther was concerned and his stand with being a nationalist. He felt that it was extremely important for every single German to support their form of government and to be a nationalist. This is important. The other thing, he did feel strongly that he was hoping the Jews would convert. Now this gets more extreme with the religious as you go through, and particularly with the Lutherans. But you know, when you stop and consider that most of us base many of our beliefs upon what Luther taught in his interpretations of the Bible, it's kind of shocking to realize that he was such an anti-Semitist. In 1940, a religious book was quoting from Luther in his instructions. And this is a direct quote. Set their synagogues and schools on fire, and whatever will not burn, heap deep dirt upon and cover, so that no human ever again will see a stone or a cinder of it. Can you imagine? That's part of our heritage. Now, think about the Christians in Germany. This is part of their heritage. This is what they're being taught. So mentally, we talk about brainwashing almost in the wave, mentally this is in their background. You have to think about that when you're thinking about those who stood off on the side and did nothing.
Yeah.
Definitely. Then there are some of the myths of the Jews. This is also was part of their background and their environment. Anybody know what any of those myths were?
They eat Christian children.
Yes, exactly. They kill Christian children to use the blood in their matzah balls.
Or during their ceremonies, during the Black Plague. That's, if you read the history of the Black Plague, you'll see that, they a lot of times thought the Jewish people were causing the plague or poisoning the wells, or during their ceremonies, as Laura said, you know, took the blood of Protestant babies. But that, Barbara Tuchman talks about that, and that was just a fascinating history.
Yeah.
It goes way back to before the Middle Ages.
There are drawings of Jews showing, I don't know, eyes in the back of their head, and all kinds of freakish things that people believed in the Jews.
Well, and they were put in newspapers, and unfortunately, even today, many times we believe everything that's in the paper as gospel. This is true. And they were put in the newspaper as a form of propaganda. And it was working, obviously.
Catherine Colberti, which is set in the medieval times, and they have some Jews just in their home for the night, you know, because they need a place to stay. And she goes and peeks in on them so she can see their horns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The myths that centered around them were unbelievable.
Well, it's also true that you don't have to go that far back, because given the turmoil of Germany at the time, the fact that Jews were seen as money, the money handlers, and that they had all the economic power, mm-hmm. and that somehow they had the money and the control of the money,
and they had to have
one of the biggest
done things. Something illegal or wrong with the rest of the world to have all that money.
Well, Germany was in the middle of a deep depression, too.
Yeah, oh, Germany definitely was. Yeah, we've talked about that a couple of times, how important it was to realize that the depression influenced a lot of people. But at the same time, we need to realize who were the ones that persecuted the Jewish people or did nothing. Even persecuted and exterminated the Jewish people. Every one of them were Christian. That's scary. Every single one of them were Christian.
Are you including Hitler as a Christian? I mean, I think he pretty much wasn't, was he?
I think he was an agnostic. I do believe he believed there was a power beyond, but he didn't practice any kind of religion. But all of those who were in the SS, those who were in the Gestapo, they were all Christians. They fell into the category of Christians as opposed to Jews.
Okay. I have a question. Were there similar myths about the gypsies?
Yeah, there were other myths about the gypsies, not necessarily those same ones,
yeah.
But yes, some really strange beliefs about the gypsies.
They stole children.
Oh, they stole children. They did weird things in their little camps, you know, and people did all this same thing as you were talking about in the book that you had read. They would sneak in to see what they were doing because they were very fearful of it. Not knowing it and understanding it, which is not unlike most of us. If we don't know something and understand it, we are fearful of it many times. This next term, have any of you German background? Any of you know what Volk is? V-O-L-K? What is it?
It's the people.
It's the people, the community, right. And there was a strong belief that was propagated all the way through during this time, that you did things for the Volk. And when you did things for the Volk, that means sometimes they might not be real comfortable for you, but you did it for the betterment. We might look at it as nationalism for your own country. In the Christian community, though, and in the community of Germany, the Volk was Aryan only. And that's the big thing you need to keep in mind. Now, with this kind of background, and with Luther background there, what was being taught in the pulpits? I mean, Luther was way back when? But what were the theologians and the priests and the pastors teaching in the pulpit? They had to be teaching the same beliefs.
Nationalism, anyway.
Yes, yes. And as things progressed, as the government decided new little regulations against the Jews, the priests and pastors carried them out in the pulpit. Now that's the environment. It's easy to become a bystander if every Sunday morning you're told this is what we need to do, and the Jews are not a part of this, or the Jews need to be removed from our community, and this is where all of that type of attitude comes from. Now, I started out by saying that all the perpetrators, so to speak, were Christians. To realize that 49% of the population of Germany was Catholic. 25% of that population was in the military. So if you think that the Catholics, because they believe in God and Jesus and they believe in the Bible, were going to do anything different than support the Volk and support all the rules that came down from the Nazis, you're crazy. It's not going to be any different. That's all a part of it. Now, let's leave the Catholics for a minute and look at the other Christians. There were two groups that I've listed up there. The German Christians and the Institute for Eradication of the Jews. The German Christians, there were 600,000 members in that group. That's an interesting group because the first thing that they decided to do in 1932 was to become a racially pure church, supporting the national theory that you cannot have Jews as a part of your community. They wanted to destroy and get rid of everything that was Jewish. They went so far later on as to want to change parts of the Bible, parts of their liturgy, and take out the Jewish words, like Hallelujah, Jehovah. Those are Jewish words. And they wanted to remove those because this is the way. Now, in this kind of an environment, you should be able to begin to understand why there were bystanders, people who wouldn't do anything. The one thing that they didn't agree with the Nazis on, the German Christians, was their stand on the handicapped. They did not think that the handicapped should be persecuted. They thought that those people were a part of their society that needed to be helped and dealt with. So they didn't agree with them on that. Everything else, though, they went along with. They particularly believed that in 1933, that if they supported everything that the Germans believed in, that they became immune from really doing any wrong. In many of their political documents, and by political I mean written documents that they put out there as part of the church, they took those stands. But we're not doing anything wrong, we're doing what is in the best interest of the Volk, and we are immune from being wrong.
Are the German Christians an organization?
It was an organization that was started by a number of people. Let's see if I can remember who they were. There was an Emmanuel.
So they came from all various faiths and joined this
denomination.
Movement. Yes, yes. And their whole. But you have to consider that most of the churches in Germany were either Catholic or Lutheran.
So these three groups, well, besides the Catholics, the German Christians and the Institute for the Eradication of Jews, those were two separate groups outside of the Lutheran Catholic.
They were made up of people from those groups. And the Eradication group actually was an extreme arm. They broke away from the close German Christians because they're the ones that actually went as far as to say we need to remove every reference in all of our liturgies in church to the Jews. They're the ones that said that scripture we need to get rid of. We need to believe that maybe the Old Testament really isn't the Word of God. And they were also the ones who promoted immediately
the idea that Jesus was an Aryan. He was not a Jew.
How big was the German population in World War?
I'm not a history teacher.
I'll be very honest.
I don't remember. But to realize how strongly they felt about this afterwards, and they look back on it, they did come out in 1945. This whole consortium of the German Christians, they came out with a statement called the Stuttgart Declaration of Guilt, in which they admitted what they had done and what part that played in. Now, they didn't do this initially from inside. They found out by not taking a stand, by not making a declaration like this, they were being condemned by people all over the world. And they wanted some acceptance. And they wanted to have basically them to say that they were credible churches. And that could only happen if they admitted that they had been wrong in these areas. Okay, let's look at the Catholics. Catholics are an interesting group during this period of time, because in 1933, I mentioned this the other day, they had signed a concordat with a representative of the Pope. The Germans had. Hitler came to Bishop Berning and said, and a prelate, and said to him, you know, all of these years the Jews have been nothing more than parasites. They've taken everything from you, which goes along with what I think you were saying as far as the period of time and depression. You know, people will believe this if they're experiencing extreme depression. You know, well, where did all the money go? Who has it? Well, look, the Jews have it. They're parasites. They feed off of us. They live off of us. So Hitler had an agreement signed with the church at that time. In 1935, the government had made a statement that it was illegal to marry a non-Aryan. Well, how do you answer that? You can't say, because there are a lot of converted Jews in Germany, you can't say that they can't get married, because that makes you look bad. So what you say is, you two want to get married, you're a non-Aryan, you're Aryan. We have to go by the state law. They always deferred to national law on that. So they felt they weren't making that decision at the time, and it was easier to accept. Then remember, because of the Nuremberg laws, where they couldn't do that. In 1938, there was an Aryan clause that the church itself, the Catholic Church itself, came out with. And that Aryan clause said that no teachers and no priests could be anything but Aryan. Now, there were a lot of Jewish Christian priests, Jewish Catholic priests. They had converted to Catholicism. They were no longer allowed to teach. They were no longer allowed to be in the pulpit. That was a strong statement for
them. I have a question.
Yes.
Italians weren't Aryan, right?
Italians weren't Aryan.
And so if you were an Italian priest and you couldn't go to Germany and preach?
Right. But they were particularly looking at the Jews. I'm going to talk about a community in Italy in a few minutes that was really an interesting community. It was off on an island, and they had to deal with an issue similar to that.
So are these things that are happening in the German Catholic Church? Because the Pope is Italian.
I mean, the German Catholic Church, but the Pope heads the church, regardless of
exactly where
he is.
And so how could they make a proclamation like that?
So the Pope couldn't.
90% of the church outside Germany isn't Aryan.
Pope. Well, this is these are the beliefs within Germany, and as it was, as we start looking at the Pope himself and at the Papal See, they refused to make a statement on any of this. He was approached by numerous bishops and archdiocese representatives, even representatives from the United States government and some of the governments in Western Europe, to take a stand. I mean,
well,
churches...
There's a lot of controversy about about that too, because on the other side there were a lot of threats toward parishioners that were made to him, basically saying if you take a stand, people will die. So, very hard spot to be in.
That's right, and that you can understand why he became a bystander. Although, as Christians, we look at that, and he was a leader. He was someone that people would have followed.
Even today in the Minneapolis paper and stuff, they sort of apologized. They still haven't really come open.
But the Vatican has denied researchers access to the materials in the Vatican library
that would verify that they knew all the information.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the Pope did last year come out and go. He said he was sorry for the part that the Catholic Church played in the Holocaust. He went to the Wailing Wall. He is trying to make amends now. Now, this is after the fact, and I have to give him credit for that, but I do think that at the time, this is one area we could have looked at for some kind of leadership or some kind of speaking out in the night.
I have another question, sorry.
Sure, that's all right.
The head rabbi in Rome actually converted to Catholicism after the war. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
And actually said that it was because of his relationship with the Pope during the war that led him to do that, and the role that the Pope played in terms of trying to save people.
I would question that.
He did become Catholic.
No, I don't question that at all. I would question the amount of his role, because in one particular...
That's why it's confusing. That's why...
It is. I would really question that, because one of the individuals that talked to us, who was a survivor from the Holocaust, was a fellow named... I wrote his name down because I always forget. It's Yaakov Henley. And he was a Jew from Salonika. And he told us about a story of an island just off the coast of Italy. And at the time, they were trying to bring together 8,000 Jews that they had registered and send them to Auschwitz. And they knew where these people were according to registers from the Catholic churches, those that were converted Jews. And there was this one priest on an island who had been told, "We're coming tomorrow for all your non-Aryan members. We will be here tomorrow morning." And he looked them straight in the face and he said, "We will be ready. All that are non-Aryan, we'll have them ready." The next morning they came to pick them up and take them up, and all of the members of his congregation were gone except him. He had sent him out by boat. And he says, "Where are your non-Aryan members?" And he says, "I'm here." He was Jewish, had converted to Catholicism, and was a priest, and he went with them. But out of the 8,000 that they hoped for out of Italy at that time, they only got 1,000 that went to Auschwitz, because some of the Catholic priests did take a stand. But where did they get the list? Where did they know to look for these? Well, they're all kept in the papacy. And I have to personally feel that the Pope had a more active role in that aspect of it than they did in some of the others.
Was that Pius? Pius the 12th?
Yeah. The 10th, wasn't it?
12,
Something.
Mm-hmm. There was one section in here I wanted to read to you about, going on about this roundup also. Now, that was at that time, but here was another section. This is out of that book, Betrayal, which is in the bookstore here. It's the German churches and the Holocaust. And it says, "The test came on the night of October 15th while the roundup was still going on. A letter was delivered to General Stahel, the German military commander of Rome, bearing the signature of Bishop Hadal, the head of the German church in Rome. And it said, 'I have just been informed by a high Vatican office in the immediate circle of the Holy Father that the arrests of Jews of Italian nationality have begun this morning. in the interest of the good relations which have existed until now between the Vatican and the High German Military Command, I would be very grateful if you would give an order to stop these arrests in Rome and its vicinity right away. I fear that otherwise the Pope will have to make an open stand which will serve the anti-German propaganda as a weapon against us. Now, here was one of those what I call lone voices in the night. A bishop who was speaking out and actually trying to blackmail the German military by saying, you know, if you don't stop these arrests of these Italians, the Pope may have to speak out. So there were lone voices out there. There were people that spoke out. I think there was a Provost Lichtenberg of Berlin. He was 66 years old. He didn't believe in any of this stuff. So every day he prayed aloud for all the Jews. What do you suppose happened? He was arrested on October 23rd, 1941, and he died en route to Dachau. There was a doctor, Edith Stein. Now, she wrote to the Pope, and she had made a very formal written request for papal interference. It was declined. She was arrested August 1942 by the Gestapo and sent to Auschwitz.
And she's now a saint.
Yes, yes. So there were people like that in the Catholic Church. There were the lone voices, but many of them were very fearful, and they didn't have the leadership to tell them to do something as a group. Now, the last part of today, what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at Bonhoeffer and then do some real good general discussion about those three questions that I have over there. What can we learn? What can we do to prevent in the future? As a Christian, what is the best plan of action? And then maybe if we have time, a little discussion about what is our role with it, with Israel and Palestine today, if there is a role. I think it is not surprising that Dietrich Bonhoeffer did what he did. He had a grandmother who was 91, and she believed in a basic concept of right and wrong. And here's a story about her. In April of 33, you know, they put a boycott on all Jewish businesses. You weren't allowed to participate with them as far as buying or selling things throughout Germany. She went shopping as usual to buy her butter from a Jewish shopkeeper. An SA man posted outside the store reportedly asked her, "Do you really have to buy from the Jew of all people?" She racked her cane on his high boots, 91, shoved him aside and said in her Swabian dialect, "I will buy my butter where I always buy my butter." According to Emmy Bonhoeffer, Dietrich's sister-in-law, that was the only customer of the day for that shopkeeper. So it's not too surprising that when we start looking at Bonhoeffer, we see some real strong feelings. Now, there are some people who say he was not a saint and that he often spoke out against the Jews. And I think to look at that, we have to look at first his own personal beliefs, what he was like. One of his best friends was a converted Jew who was a theologian. And in 1933, he wrote a paper, and I think this is where they come up with the fact that he didn't support the Jews all along. It had three aspects to it. The first aspect said that you must obey the state. Well, that sounds kind of contradictory with supporting the Jewish people if you obey the state. Kind of wishy-washy, maybe. The next one said you need to stand in solidarity with the Jews in their struggle. This was all in one paper that he'd written in 33. And the third one was, once you stand in solidarity, you take a political action. Well, both of those are pretty strong stands. The first one sounds a little wishy-washy. He did make a statement that has been quoted many times. Only he who cries out for the Jews may sing Gregorian chants. Hmm. What does that mean?
I would think it might mean that whoever cries out, can, he's the only one that really should be allowed to praise God, maybe.
That's right.
The only one who was really a Christian.
That's right. That's right. Now, in 19, he, all the time, between 1933 and 1938, he was continually writing, speaking out, visiting people, training. He had a seminary where he was training pastors for churches and educators. And they tried all sorts of things. They told him, you can't do this, you can't do that, none of that worked. He continued. So in 1938, they finally shut down his seminary. And he couldn't have them all collected together. Have any of you seen the public broadcasting video of Bonhoeffer? Last year, this past summer, or spring, when was it, Whitey? And before Easter, I believe. They showed it in Minneapolis, through the Minneapolis station. And our pastor had told us about it on Sunday, and I missed it the first time, but they always play everything twice. Sometimes the other is at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
But wonderful production of his life, telling the struggles that he went through and his strong belief as he went along. Even after his seminary was shut down, he still went out and taught these people. He just went to different places to teach. His building was closed, but he'd go and teach them elsewhere. There was something that was the turning point, and that was called the Abwehr Plan, and that was to rescue Jewish people who were supposed to be deported. And it also had a part two called Operation 7. As a result of that, when they found out he was the one that was the mastermind behind it, and there is a plan or a theory that he also was the mastermind behind the plan to assassinate Hitler. And at that point, they didn't arrest him for that. They arrested him for his plan to help all of these Jewish people get out of Germany. And the thing was, they were successful in getting most of them out. But as a result of that, he was arrested, and then he eventually died in April of 1945 at the Flossenbürg concentration camp. He probably is the loudest lone voice that we know about, especially we who are Lutheran and in the Christian world. Now, there were a lot of people who did nothing. They were the bystanders. I hope you understand better why they were bystanders, understanding the environment around them. Now, I had mentioned before, I was going to just refer to it, the French, the Dutch, the Belgium, there's one other country, those Catholic priests had decided that they needed to talk publicly. And they did. And I think that's the reason the one community up there in France felt so strongly that they had to help all these people. I think it was because their priests and their pastors spoke out in saying that this is not what Christians do. This is against the word of God. I mean, when you think about it, both the German Christians and the Catholics came to a point where they wanted to disregard everything in the Old Testament, because that is Jewish law. They were only going to look at the New Testament, and then from the point of view that Christ was not a Jew, but an Aryan, and that the books spoke out against Jews in the New Testament. When you think about that, and this is being preached to you on Sunday, priesthood soaks in that, well, maybe these Jews really are bad people. And that's one of the reasons I think bystanders played such an important role by doing nothing. Okay, any comments or questions on that? Then I want to get to my three questions.
You listed the Dutch, the French, and the third country.
France, Belgium, Dutch.
And
actually, the bishops.
Denmark
was a neutral country that really did a lot for the people. Yeah.
I mean,
but they didn't have a bishop. I don't think that spoke out. See, the bishop spoke out. The priest.
Not from a Catholic viewpoint, but just in terms of countries that actually.
Yes, they would fall among the righteous. And actually, I think you'll find quite a large percentage of those that have been recognized by the Jewish people as being righteous came from Denmark. You wouldn't believe what they did to their population for a couple of years there, as far as increasing the size of it by letting people.
Well, I thought they also, a lot of the personal boats, I mean, they took people out and actually reserved their apartments and... I read.
They eliminated all.
And finding money and food in their apartments. After.
They tried to eliminate the Jews that were in Denmark before the Germans got there, before anybody could find them, get them out of the country, so they wouldn't be persecuted. That's right. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to raise the question about the United States. The United States government knew what was going on. But I lived then, and I didn't know what was going on. And they tried to keep it from the American people.
The United States government said that they didn't know until a certain period of time. And as of last year, the actual documentation as to when they heard about it, and they did know about it in 1938 that it was going on. They did not, you're right, they did not tell
us. The Quakers knew about it, and they wrote to the United States government and informed them.
That's correct. Wayne?
Well, everything we were fed during World War II was pretty much propaganda. Yeah. Just remember, the government controlled all the letters that came anywhere overseas or here, anything about anything, and the government told what you could tell so it wasn't help the Germans, you know, right? Under that classification, you could depress any kind of news you wanted to. And they did. At least that's what we were told in service in Roswell, New Mexico on top secret cruise. And the government did. It was propaganda like propaganda. And they kept it from us.
Well, besides...
Here and here would sneak through. You know, you hear a word here and there.
Besides not sharing that knowledge, we also closed our doors to immigrants. Jewish immigrants. We made a conscious decision not to allow them into the country when people needed to go somewhere for a long time.
Einstein got in.
Well, why?
That's before he came in the 20s, isn't it?
I'm not sure when he came into the United States.
Who's that?
Einstein.
Oh. You're not sure when he came over?
Yeah.
Early 30s at the latest.
Yeah. Or maybe when it first started.
Well,
we didn't close our doors immediately, but we had them closed before in 38. We just refused to let them come in. Any other comments? Okay. What can we learn from this? Or maybe we should go from the bottom up. As a Christian, what is the best plan of action, or what can we do to prevent it happening again?
One thing is, I guess, keep open communications.
Now, keeping open communications, how do we do that?
Well, you allow all the voices to talk.
Okay.
You don't silence any voices, even if you don't agree with them.
How about demanding that the open communications occur?
Mm-hmm.
Continue to insist that they're there. Because like some of you have mentioned, there's an easy way to control the press. And the press controls our mind, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can't be so prejudiced. We have to watch how we are reacting. And I hope people are aware of the Sons of Aryan and what a great movement that is today. I know there are 38 communities of the Sons of Aryan in the state of Pennsylvania alone, and now... Of course, in Idaho, they had a legal, battle last year, and the Sons of Aryan lost their headquarters. But there are they're Nazi and still, you know, are against black people or Jewish people or non-Aryan people.
What do we do about groups like that? They're all over. In Minnesota, they call them skinheads, but their beliefs are the same. They're against blacks. They're against Jews. They're very strong against migrants from Mexico. They'll take action against them, physical action against them. What can we do about that? I mean, we can be aware of it, but what can we do?
One of the things they did in Idaho was every year they had a march, a protest march. The Aryan Nation would march on 4th of July. I forget what day they chose. They would march down the street in this little dinky town, and there would be a large, much larger protest march. People would say, you shouldn't do that. You're just giving them free advertisement. But I think there is some point to the large people who don't agree with them meeting and showing support and showing strength. Because when you'd see the pictures, you'd see a bunch of Aryan Nation people walk by, and then surrounding them were people that looked like all kinds of people. They all had waving things.
You know, they. Me back to what I had said about the movie The Wave. I think you could, and it also is what Hitler used in Germany. First of all, you have discipline, self-discipline. You have a sense of community, and if we broadened our community to include all human beings, and when any of them were threatened, then we look at an action to take, such as the one you're talking about. We could take his techniques, turn them around, and use them as a plan. As long as our community included all, I think therein the problem lies.
Mm-hmm. And I think that trust is a huge part of it too. You know, we need to have trust for our neighbor.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You can't be fearful of your neighbor.
I don't think there's any way you could really second guess how people would act. I mean, it seems almost like this is an example of what happens when the mob mentality takes over. And it's probably this standard isn't going to change. You know, every time something happens, I think the most that we as Christians can expect to be are lone voices that continue to just hammer the point across. And you know, I think once you get into Christians as a larger group resisting, it becomes another kind of mob mentality in a way. You know, I mean, who knows what would happen? I mean, maybe it would just fizzle anything else out. But given all the circumstances leading up to this, the way things were working and you know, I just think about stuff that's going on now in politics and in our world, in our country, and how can you point to one thing or another and say, well, this is the start of this? You know, gun control is the start of taking away our rights here. Well, maybe it's not. You know, maybe nothing will happen from that, but maybe it is. So what do you rush to and try to defend, or do you just wait?
Well, and this is one of the things we talked about that one day when we were talking about the signs. What signs were out there that nobody paid attention to as you went along? Historically, we could go year by year. What new things were implemented? Well, it didn't seem so bad to register your property. We have to pay taxes. Yet when they registered their property, eventually they lost their property. When
you take a census, I mean, did you fill out what your race was?
Did I fill out the census?
Did anybody come to your door yet? Has anyone come to your door yet?
They're not going to come back there. We live so far.
What I had heard legally was that all you are required to do is fill out how many people live in your house and where you live. And yet people were following through. If you didn't fill it out completely, they were coming back and saying you have to.
Yeah, I had heard that was
I had
go ahead.
I had an interesting experience a few months ago. We had a pretty active white supremacist in our community who was leafleting my library everywhere on anti-black, anti-Jew, all kinds of ugly materials. Mm-hmm. And it was a very interesting thing because the library is by law a public forum and he is allowed free speech. And so I had to defend his right to post. I had to enforce the posting policy so he couldn't. He was plastering it in bathrooms and putting them in books all over, and he couldn't do that. And I had to tell him that he would be arrested if he did anything but what was allowed. But then we had to allow him to put that material on our public notice board. And he was doing this all over the eastern part of Iowa and then was arrested at Augustana because they are a private school and did not have to mm-hmm. abide by the same rules that I do. But it was pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. And it was really gratifying to see how outraged most of my customers were. It was a learning experience for all of us.
I'm curious about the laws of freedom of speech. And how I hadn't heard that part of the story. Mm-hmm. What laws? Aren't there laws against what would it be? Anti-defamation? What are the laws against
defamation of character?
Yeah. But I mean, aren't there laws against a race or against a sexual preference? Don't we have laws? No, maybe not sexual preference yet, but we certainly have laws, you know, race, anti-race, you know.
No.
We don't have laws.
There is no speech laws.
No,
I mean, that we're, it's remarkable. Because that's what I said.
You can't,
I went to the event.
An individual.
There's great freedom of speech, and we protect it, and which is a good thing.
Yeah, I'm in favor of freedom of speech.
And it can't be for just the speech you like.
Right.
But that's what. Where would you draw the line? I mean,
that's
maybe
right.
speech
yeah.
that you wouldn't allow.
Anytime you abuse somebody else, some human rights, that would be the bottom line for me.
Except it's all subjective.
Well, to me, it isn't. Again,
I
would
not,
call an attorney, but don't we have basic constitutional rights?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one.
Yes.
One
of them is the right of freedom of speech, but what
one.
About, we've got to have rights against racism, don't we?
No.
No?
No.
Well, no, you have rights against acting, but not thinking it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't.
I mean, you can't burn a cross on somebody's lawn.
This is my point with people who are righteous, with people who are Christians, and say, why can't we stop bad thinking? Why can't we stop this? We fall into just as bad a position as the Nazis. You know, why can't we control people who are thinking these bad things?
Yes, I would be against that too. Even if agree with what they disliked. I agree with freedom of speech, but it seems to me there should be some limits. You know, you have that stereotypical idea. The notion you can't yell fire in the theater.
That's different.
That
is protected.
That endangers. The
you can't incite a riot. You can't get people to be violent.
You and I can debate as much as we want, no matter what the subject is. That's freedom of speech. But when I get the rest of these people all against you, that's a different story. Totally.
Physically.
And yet you still also, we fought like crazy, I can't remember what years, to get the right to congregate and to
assembly.
What was
right
it?
Assembly.
Yeah, right assembly. So now where does that? That's pretty fine now. I mean, I get all these people one side, that's right of assembly, and yet I can't attack you.
These white supremacists meet at the Peoria, I think it's Peoria Public Library in Illinois, and they have to let them meet in their meeting rooms
mm-hmm.
Because of the freedom of speech, whatever, in the public forum things. And they can only have rules against noise, certain things like that, but they have to let them say what they want to say.
Well, they have to schedule it, I would assume.
Yeah, they have to meet the scheduling.
And Faye is director of the library, and I think the librarians are expected to present every viewpoint in their library. They aren't just to have one line. They're supposed to have available materials presenting every viewpoint. And I was surprised. I have a good friend in Philadelphia who's a gay Lutheran pastor, and he had a huge swastika spray painted on his car. And I said, how would they know? How would they know about you?
So I'm still, I have to talk to some attorney. This is really puzzling to me, and I don't know the laws. My son's an attorney, I have to call him. But it seems to me that people like that shouldn't be able to fall through the cracks. I mean, I'm much in favor, you know, I'm Civil Liberties Union, I'm in favor of all those people. But, and I know we had a group of Nazis, neo-Nazis, marching in Skokie, which is heavily Jewish in the north side of Chicago there. There was a big uproar about that. And if they would have asked me, I would have let them march. But what I would have liked to have done is have informative sessions in the library about what the rules are in terms of freedom of speech, what these people actually say, and you know, what the ramifications and history of this kind of thing.
We used it as an opportunity to educate our community about freedom of speech. We explained it in our newsletter and all of that so that they understood. And it was, I think in the long run, although I did not enjoy it as I went through it, it was a good experience.
Well, if I think of the last two elements of that what I had been talking about before as far as community in action, that's exactly what you did, though. You included as community the people that were being threatened or that were being put down, and you included as action a way of communicating some ideas, a forum for that. I don't think there's an answer. I think you're right on. It's something inside that you have to decide to do. You can't, because if you start forming action groups against someone else, you're not any better than they are.
I think what's the most difficult thing in the world is to find that in-between point in your heart, because it's either you want to control someone and you do the right-ish stuff in that, or you just totally step back and you're a bystander.
That's right.
So, I mean,
exactly, and it's a hard thing to find out.
You want to watch the wave if you haven't seen it, because we've seen it. So.
Yeah, okay. And I have the video, and you can watch it. It's
So are you saying this is a solidarity group that's seen?
We're right. Yeah.
I would like to just have one little thing, which is when you talk about, well, then does it have to all be lone voices, and what if we try to organize just a little sample. I live in Bellingham, and we were starting to have racist incidents. We had beatings of some clearly racially motivated. We had a cross burning at a migrant camp outside of town. It was getting pretty scary. And a group what grew out of that was a human rights task force, for one thing. But even before that, I was a group of preschool group of mothers. There were nine of us. We became the Nine Mothers of Bellingham. And we formed a group. And what came out of the group was just a little logo, you know, primarily, that started being put in the windows of all the businesses in town and homes that just said, basically it was sort of taking off of something that had happened, I believe, in Idaho. It just basically said, not in our town. It was joining hands against hate. Mm-hmm. And it was just a way of responding and saying, you're not welcome here.
She took an action. And it didn't stand back.
It was really important to do something. Mm-hmm. What it was based on was this wonderful story, maybe you told already in your series, of I believe it was in Idaho, in which there were sort of like in our town, it started subtle but increasing acts of violence and harassment against non-whites, and culminated in a stone through a window where a swastika was displayed, and sprayed glass that very nearly injured some of the child that was sleeping in that room. The rock came through. And the community was so incensed, and I don't remember how it came together, how the action happened, but within a few days, every window in that town had a swastika, the Jewish
menorah.
That, and that's what had been in the window, the menorah. The menorah had been in the window, and that's where the stone came through. And so every window in town had a menorah in it. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a very powerful story.
And solidarity, for sure.
Oh, okay. This was over public radio at least 10 years ago. You know, the IRA, and I'm talking about Ireland, was powerful and going, you know, and all run by men, and you're a standout too, because you know why it's dropped down? I mean, if you stop to think, that should have escalated and kept up flying. But instead of that, a few women started out and said, absolutely no. And they got together, and they all got together. And that is why that IRA is now even thinking about giving up their arms, is because these women had such an influence over all these years, and really anti anything that that army was trying to do, you know, or people, their talk, they've got them down now to where they're sitting there throwing their arms. Which is really speaking well for that organization.
Power of women.
Yes.
Well, it was. I mean,
the power is the problem, though.
That's the problem, and sometimes that's the solution.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's the two. We can discuss some other things, but I would like you, just for my sake, because I've never done this before, and I would like you to write on here for me something that you think would improve the class, something that you really liked, something that might maybe needs to be added, because I'll be doing it again next week, and I'd like to. I'm a teacher who always is looking for ways to change things. I also did bring along some of my slides from when I was in Europe. If anybody is interested in looking at them, they're welcome to. And if you want to know about that video and want to see if you can get your hands on it and read it, or read it, watch it, talk to me about it. Now, we could go to this last one. We'll pass these around.
I'll pass around.
Okay. Here are some things. I found some in my suitcase at home. What about Israel and Palestine? Is there anything that we can do there? Israel and Palestine. Between the Jews and the Palestinians. Between the Israelis.
Stop reading the mainstream newspaper and getting our news from that source.
That would help. Anything else?
Well, we have a lot of trade with Israel, and we have a lot of aid with Israel, and we can start putting strings on it.
So we would have to take action to inform our government that we need to put some restrictions.
So what's the assumption that what Israel is doing is wrong?
That's, there you go. She brought up the question, is Israel wrong? Are the Palestinians wrong? Who's wrong here? Is there someone that is wrong? And is it our business to do something?
Well, I would say they're both wrong. And, yes, because they're killing each other, and children are dying and on both sides. And it seems it's not just military action. It's on both sides. It's the whole people are fighting the other whole people. And I don't say that Israel is wrong. Israel's where we have ties.
I'll give just a little insight on that. When I was over there, I visited one school. One of the things that they have done is they have brought together in camps Israeli children, Palestinian children, and kept them in camps for a couple of weeks to see, you know, how things go. They get along fine, just like they're all Israelis, they're all Palestinians. There's such a weird history behind this. As far as the Israelis were promised Israel back at the beginning of biblical times, Israel was not a nation, and the Jewish people were not there in full force. The Palestinians set up their homes, their businesses, their communities. And all of a sudden, all these Jews come in after World War II, and it's like pushing them out, and it's a struggle. If you talk to the adults over there, they will say the real struggle is not between the Israelis and the Jews, but between the radical factions of each one. If you could eliminate the radical factions...
Israelis and Palestinians.
Yes, that's what I meant. I'm sorry. Thank you. If you could eliminate those, there'd be no problem. They'd come to a conclusion, because they came very close to one.
Okay.
There still is... I don't know. My first husband is Jewish, and I have a lot of friends in that community, and they universally, and these are people born and raised in the Midwest, hate Arabs. I mean, that's just it. They just do. And they're uncomfortable, and they see a person with the tone of skin and structure that they, and they're you can just feel them. You can, they just, right? And it's going to take an unusual amount of change.
So what do we
stop that?
There's a young man that's come to Holden for a year, and last year he worked in Maine in a community of peace where half of the community were Jews and half Arabs. And on the in the library, in the circulation room on the reserve shelf, there's a periodical from that movement. It's called The Olive Branch, and it shows a Jewish boy that was murdered at that camp by an Arabian boy. These are all under 20. And he spoke to us one evening at Holden here. But those materials, you know, are available to read if you're interested. And we could even ask him personally. He's the one that plays the cello for the worship services.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, I think it's something we need to think about, because so many times people say, well, we have to do something about it. I'm not sure, personally, that it's our place to do something about it. I think it's our place to learn from that situation. And maybe the biggest thing we can do is pray about it, but I don't know beyond that.
You know, honestly, I've got to go back now. You really gave me a chop. I'm going to go back and find out who that speaker was, because those women did something so simple. I mean, I can't remember what it was. They didn't go to this, you know, this meetings where these men were. They did something so simple. It just escapes me now. They control it today. I mean, they do today. I don't know, I suppose.
Well, it's food for thought anyway. Nothing else. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
I would disagree with you about doing nothing. I have one woman that I know, a Jewish woman, who takes groups of Jews, and often very traditional Jews, into the camps, into where the Palestinian refugees are, and gets them to face to face have conversations. And some of the most moving stories I have ever heard have come out of the work that she has organized and she does.
But so she is doing it.
Feels like
I don't mean nothing should occur, but she is doing it as a Jewish person,
yes,
taking people in Israel there. I'm saying here, I am not sure that it's our place
as a government
or as a group of people to put our nose into it. Maybe support something like that, because that is very effective. I saw it in classrooms. I talked to some of these kids when I was over there, and they have no bad feelings.
I think keeping in mind, though, that Israel, of all the Middle Eastern governments, is the least oppressive and the most democratic, but there still is this...
It may depend on who you talk to. Because if you talk to Palestinians, I don't think they'd see that way.
Oh, they were all kicked out of Jordan. The Jordans didn't want them. I mean, it's not like they haven't been persecuted elsewhere by other Arabs.
I would like those pens back too, those of you that have them, because some of them are mine.
Very expensive, right?
You need paper too. Thank you. If you wanted to borrow one of these to read, you may just make sure I get it back. I'm in room 6 or lodge 4. And if you want to find out about that video, I'd be very glad to.
make arrangements for that.
I'd like you guys to see Wade. Do you have anything to do with that?
Thank you.
Come to your biscuit.
You think
that
you could make a coffee?
All right, very much.
That's
thank
all right.
Very much. Thank you. I do have some information about the rabbi bowl.
Right.
You know, it's like it's a perspective because,
sure.
First of all, you know, anybody who's not doing what they're supposed to, it doesn't. If they do just a little bit, it doesn't mean that it kind of moves on.
You were on the rest of the day, and we're leaving tomorrow.
There were a lot of Christians who did stuff, but at the same time.